Welcome to the Podcast for Happiness series, episode 3. I'm your host, Ski, and alongside Anne, we'll be speaking with Joe Marshall, author of Managing Anxiety with Mindfulness for Dummies. Joe's a big supporter of Action for Happiness, and it's actually at one of their events where we first met. Listening as we discuss the evolution of anxiety, how perfectly natural it is, and how mindfulness can help take more control over this. So Joe, thank you very much for agreeing to do this.
Thank you.
And we all have varying forms of anxiety in our lives, and some people cover it well, and some are so deeply affected by it that it severely impacts their life. So Joe, is it normal to feel anxiety?
Yeah, it's very normal. It's actually a very human trait. We actually have basically developed it over the years because it's to do with our stress response and our fight or flight response. If we didn't ever feel anxious, we as a human race would have never survived. If we never worried about what was going to happen to us, or whether our children were safe, and whether a big cave bear was going to come and eat us, or right. it's actually a very normal part. It's when it gets excessive that's when the trouble starts.
So it's an evolutionary kind of almost a defense mechanism that's helped us.
Yeah, definitely. Yes.
So I guess culturally, why is it a sign of weakness then to show that we're affected by it?
It's a difficult one. I guess because people want to kind of show that they're strong and that they're not kind of pushed down by feeling anxious, or that they don't want to appear as weak. It's a part of the human condition of, I guess, trying to put on a facade for things. Mm-hmm. It's actually just a very normal part of life. I mean, obviously, anxiety is not very nice if you have it excessively, but actually just you know, quite a mild anxiety, and just over things that are quite normal, like, you know, being anxious about a job interview, or being anxious about you know, a wedding, or anxious, that's very normal. That's nothing to kind of fear. Or and I think that the way that society treats anxiety is getting better as a whole. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely nothing to be ashamed of, and people really kind of, I think that almost you get anxiety about showing anxiety, so that kind of exacerbates it, and then you go in a kind of a circle.
A vicious circle.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, I think maybe among men, the willingness to show anxiety is slightly less. There's that stigma attached to, you know, being macho.
Yeah.
And if you're sort of, you know, showing any signs of weakness, I think it's slightly worse. I don't know if you have any...
I would actually totally agree with that. Yeah, I think, you know, from the kind of gender roles, and which I, you know, don't really like. So, you know, for gender equality and so on, for the kind of patriarchal system, and, you know, men have to kind of show this strong up front. I mean, I think that's why we have such a problem with, like, such a high rate of male suicides as well, because, you know, it's not okay for men to show any kind of weakness, and they don't feel comfortable where they can talk to their problems and share them with friends. Like, women do that a lot more. So, yeah, I definitely agree with you there.
Yeah. I remember, when Janet Street Porter was at the Action for Happiness, they
yes,
were talking
remember,
about
yeah.
embracing vulnerability.
Yeah.
I can't remember her name. Renee Brown's talk? Is it
Renee Brown? Brené Brown, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
on vulnerability.
Vulnerability. And we came to the same conclusion about sort of men not being able to maybe express their feelings of vulnerability to each other, or, you know, so it's common, I think, whether it's anxiety, vulnerability, any sort of signs of weakness, it's more difficult for us guys, I think.
Yeah, no, I kind of, yeah, definitely agree with you there. And I think that's an evolutionary thing as well, you know, whereas women have always kind of been lived in communities where they help each other out, you know, and they find it a lot easier to kind of share. And I think, and obviously, like, from a mental health point of view, it's much better for you to kind of share and get other people to kind of listen to you.
Yeah.
It's why group situations are actually really helpful.
Yeah.
There's varying levels of anxiety. There's, I guess, what you call normal level anxiety,
yeah.
which is, you know, the evolutionary fight or flight part.
Yeah.
Before, we used to be worried about snakes and spiders and bears, so we all have to be vigilant. But we don't have these same threats nowadays, so they manifest themselves
in different ways. Yeah.
For example, I'm about to give a presentation to my boss.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm about to, you know, play, even when I have to play piano in front of friends, the fact that I'm not doing it by myself, that I'm also doing a performance now,
yeah.
the ego kicks in and it starts, you know, sweaty palms.
Yeah.
And I think that's fairly normal levels of anxiety.
Yeah.
But then there are more depressing and more, I guess, more
debilitating.
Yeah, more debilitating levels of anxiety where you literally don't want to get out of bed in the morning and you don't want to face the day or you don't want to face that your boss or something. And I think that's really where the mindfulness can help.
Yeah.
Can you help explain what the different types of anxiety are?
Well, you can. I guess you can have disorders like panic disorder. You can obviously have social anxiety. That's obviously with groups of going into social crowds, anything that is going to be a lot of people that you need to, you know, socialise with. There's kind of a few different types. You can, I mean, obviously it ranges across. I mean, that even like, you know, some depression, you can have quite severe anxiety alongside your depression as well. So there's a whole list really of anxiety disorders
right.
that you can have. I mean, OCD could really be an anxiety disorder as well.
Yeah. Have you come across that, dealing with people with severe anxiety?
Yeah, I have. I'd say for mindfulness, it's probably best that you... I think that's about mindfulness anyway. It's probably best that you don't see mindfulness as the only way. I think that a lot of severe anxiety disorders also probably need some kind of other therapy as well, such as CBT or maybe even some medication in some cases. So I think mindfulness can work alongside other therapies. It really depends on what, you know, a psychiatrist would say to that person. But if you're going simply back to just mindfulness for anxiety, basically the mindfulness kind of practices that you would do are things like just trying to stop your thoughts ruminating, just kind of being aware of how your body feels when you start to feel anxiety, doing things like the stop meditation, which is just basically stopping and then becoming aware of how your body is going and then being able to notice the triggers that are going to send you into that. It depends on kind of what the level of anxiety is with a person and also, you know, whether they're kind of ready to kind of start a mindfulness practice and whether it's going to help them over time.
Yeah.
I did teach somebody that did mindfulness and CBT at the same time. She found it really, really helpful. So I think
What is CBT?
So cognitive behavioural therapy.
Okay.
So it's kind of... It works well with mindfulness because it's more about kind of thoughts. And as well, mindfulness is about kind of accepting and allowing thoughts and being aware of what thoughts comes up. And CBT is kind of about kind of getting the thoughts and just kind of reprogramming them so you feel a bit better. But different things work for different people. So mindfulness may work for someone, CBT may work for another, or it may be a combination. So mindfulness can work for someone that has anxiety and it might just work on its own, or they might need a combination, or it really depends.
So I was going to ask, like when you said, like, are they ready for mindfulness?
Yeah.
You think like in some cases it's possibly not a good idea to maybe start some mindfulness practice?
I'd say if you haven't seen any, say you have severe anxiety, like not being able to get out of bed, and it's really, really debilitating to your life, I would say always, always seek medical advice first.
Yeah.
And then going forward from that, if they then say go and see, I think mindfulness is going to help you, then of course try it. But I would never say just do it on its own without seeking like proper medical advice first.
Yeah.
But mindfulness would basically tell you to kind of just pinpoint when you feel a bit, well, the more aware you become of your body by practicing mindfulness and so on, the more aware you can feel your emotions rising and your thoughts, then the more you can kind of stop the thoughts just going around.
Yeah.
And another thing that we do in mindfulness is for anxiety is it may sound odd to some people, but it's about kind of seeing yourself as separate from your thoughts. If you're not, if you don't have any kind of knowledge of things like Buddhism and so on, that's very, very new to some people.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's about saying that your body is a vessel that just carries emotions and it just carries thoughts, and you don't hold them. You're not attached to them. So I kind of do meditations with people where I say, what we're going to do is we're going to just, you know, go into a meditation with our concentrate on breathing and so on. And then when we become aware of a thought, we're going to place it on a cloud, or we're going to place it on a twig and watch it go through the river. Mm. Just to kind of show that person that their anxiety is not them, and it doesn't control them. And it's actually, if they can kind of watch it, their thoughts like a movie, you can then pinpoint where you can kind of change. And
it's that separate, that non-dualistic idea where you separate yourself from your thought. And as a result, there's so many other positive aspects that can come from that skill of
just being able to step back.
Yeah, and the analogy that I use is like up on a screen.
Yeah.
Almost like you're watching a movie go by.
Yeah.
You know, your twig and analogy. That's how I understood it.
I was going to say, once you notice it arising in whatever form, then I suppose that's sort of maybe stops it there from maybe sort of running off and taking a life of its own.
Once you're kind of able to be like, you know, like you said, be aware of the thoughts that are coming up and know that they're going to go into a stream, then you can just be like, you know, stop it. Because once you become aware of things, some, like, not always, but sometimes they end up dissipating, they end up going because you've then highlighted it and people that say that they don't practice meditations and they feel down all the time, or they feel anxious, or they don't realise they have this constant stream of like negativity going on. But once you're aware of that stream, once you can kind of see it, then you're like, oh no, that's silly, or I can kind of change that. Or
how you respond to it.
Yeah, you can change how you respond, definitely. And once you become aware of what's going on for you, you're like, what is actually going on? Like, why do I? Oh, it's because I'm thinking all this consistent stuff in my head that I didn't realise I was doing. So, yeah.
And it's how you have been thinking all your life.
Yeah.
It's that pattern of, you know, this happens and this is how I'm going to react.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the kind of paradigm shifting aspects of the mindfulness practice, is that, you know, you really start to understand your relationship with your thoughts. And because of that, you start seeing yourself in a new light.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite profound, and we speak like it's, you know, it's an easy step, but in fact, the journey from going, you know, from not being mindful to the point where you can separate yourself from your thoughts and start to visualize them as something different is actually a huge journey. And like, in trying to explain mindfulness and teach it to my family and friends, that's always the tricky bit, because that for me is where the real growth starts to happen. So can you perhaps explain to our listeners, for you, what is mindfulness?
Mindfulness is present moment awareness, in a very simple nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
It's just about being aware without judgment, without forcing things to be a different way. It has kind of its attitudes linked into it. So it's present moment awareness, like awareness of me thinking about what I'm doing right now, and being aware of the weight of my body on the chair and the sound of my voice and all of those things. It's also about not judging myself or judging anything. It's also about accepting my circumstances as they are. That's quite a difficult attitude, the acceptance one, because people always think it means I'm telling them to be complacent and just accept. But actually, all I'm doing is to telling them to be accepting of the now. It doesn't mean that things don't have to be different in the future.
Yeah. It doesn't mean you can't change, or you're sort of a victim of some sort of
situation.
You can still take action and change things, but that what you can't change, in a sense, you're accepting them
as
they are. Yeah.
Yes, it's. Yeah. I think that's quite an important one to cover, because there's been a little bit of negative media I've read recently about mindfulness, and that was one of the things that he said. Oh, it's just about accepting and putting up with stuff. Oh, and it's not. Mm. It's not about putting up with things. It's about accepting what's there for you now. So, for example, if you're on a tube platform and you're trying to get to work, and your tube is you're sitting on a tube train. And your tube is delayed, you're stuck in a tunnel, and you know you're going to be late for work. And you could choose two ways to react to that. You can either get really angry, and you can get really stressed, and you can start like throwing down your newspaper, or you can just accept that you're going to be late. There's nothing you can do. You can't call anyone because you're underground. You can just relax it. That doesn't mean that you then can't plan your journey to work the next day earlier.
Yeah.
It just means you accept the situation as it is right then.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's a helpful analogy.
Well, I've used that. It's very helpful. I mean, it was a Victoria line, and it was packed. I think there was a slight delay, so the platform was even mobbed.
Yeah.
And you could see people staring at their watches and looking around. And then I noticed that moment that actually it was just, there was nothing I can do. It's beyond my control. So, I think you mentioned something about being on a train full of people and it was actually a happy time. So, and in a sense,
it was only happy time because I made it into
the train. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
I was
it was like rush hour London, you know. I made it exactly that. It shouldn't have been a happy time, but actually the fact that I realised that I didn't react to it as one normally does, you know, looking at the time and just, you know, made me actually, you know, brought a smile to my face because it's like, ah, I've overcome the challenge of, you know, not reacting in the usual manner, that, you know. And so I suppose that feeling of achievement, and all of a sudden there was a slight feeling of ecstasy almost, you know.
Just because you put into practice.
Just, you know, standing there and just, you know, smiling to myself. It was quite a nice feeling, but
I mean, imagine, this is how people get stressed and anxious. I mean, imagine, like, the London transport system is not brilliant, but if you're gonna get stressed about that every day, it's not good for you.
And people do, that's the problem.
And they do,
people every day go about it not realizing that they can choose to feel a different way about it. Go in there. Well, the majority of people have to travel peak time, and it can be a nightmare.
Also, red lights are, you know, if you're at a red light, normally that triggers off.
Triggers off so much stuff.
Yeah, but you can use that time as if you're stuck in traffic, there's nothing you can do, you know, just accept what is. And I think that's a big part of, I would completely agree about, you know, the non-judgmental part of it. And it's not about being helpless, it's not about
not
taking action, but it's just accepting what is. And ultimately, what's the alternative? You know, you're just going to get stressed for no reason. There isn't, in a situation where it's beyond your control, there isn't really, you know, a better option, I would say, than to actually just accept, you know, the current situation, all the thoughts maybe running through your mind, if you notice them without judgment. What I find, you know, I don't know if this applies to you guys, but when I initially practiced mindfulness, the fact that thoughts came, I was like, wow, I'm still not good at this, you know, why am I? But that, again, that's more judgment, isn't it?
Because it's judgment,
it's not something that you can, they just come and they just pop up and they go, but I was just sort of moaning at myself for not being able to master my own thinking. You know, but then I realised actually that there's no way I can control what random thoughts come up, and that's more just more judgment. So then it's easier to see them as clouds sort of passing by once you realise that, it's just what the mind does, you know.
I think it's interesting as well to kind of say that there's no really right or wrong way to do a mindfulness meditation. If you're kind of being guided, say, for a mindfulness meditation where you're tuning into sounds, you're tuning into your body, and your mind wanders off, people say, oh, I did it really badly, my mind wandered off. And I said, no, you didn't. Like, because you became aware your mind wandered off, you then brought it back. And then your mind may wander off once, it may wander off 1,000 times. It doesn't mean that you're bad at meditation. There is no the only way you can be bad at meditation is if you fall asleep or if you can't do it. And obviously, you know, a lot of people do fall asleep when they first start, so really it's very difficult to be bad at it unless you just don't put the practice in.
And if we have 60,000 thoughts on average a day, then obviously when we're sitting down to do the meditation, you know, we are going to get these thoughts.
Of course, it's very natural. And also, another misconception about mindfulness or meditation is that it's about stopping your thoughts. Like you said, we have 60,000 thoughts a day. It's not about trying to stop those thoughts. I mean, that's our...
You make yourself
exhausted trying to stop your thoughts. All you're doing is you're just switching your focus onto being aware of something else. If your mind then wanders back to your thinking, you just gently guide it back. That's all you need to do. And you may have to do that a few times, you may have to do that 100 times. It doesn't make it bad or better. It's just about allowing and accepting what's going on in the present moment, which is what mindfulness is.
And the Viktor Frankl quote, you know, our greatest freedom is the ability to choose how we feel in any given scenario. So going back to that tube example, you could choose to be stressed, or you can choose, oh, this is actually quite nice. You know, if you see the Paris metro, you'll know that the London metro is actually not that bad. You know. So you personally, how did you get into mindfulness?
So me personally, well, about 5 years ago, I actually personally had quite a stressful time, and I won't go into the details of it, but I was kind of getting into meditation at the same time, because, you know, I'd heard it was quite good for, you know, to help you kind of get find peace and get less stressed. And I was just kind of practicing a few different meditations, really, like lots of different styles of meditation. And then I started practicing mindfulness. A friend gave me a book on it, and I read it, and He told me to give it a go, so I gave it a go.
What book was it?
It was Mindfulness for Dummies by Shamash.
Oh, really?
Yeah. and it was Shamash that gave me the book, because we were friends back then.
So you were friends with Shamash?
So I was friends with Shamash before he gave me the book, before I started practicing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew he was a mindfulness teacher, but I was kind of doing all different styles of meditation. I hadn't really found what I liked. I was just kind of having a play. Anyway, so he told me to practice this, and then I did. And then I just really felt the benefits of it. I had an open mind, which is always a good thing when you start a new practice. You definitely need an open mind. You need a lot of patience. Because you don't get instant results, and that's important to kind of say. So I just started practicing over a few weeks, then a few months, and my whole kind of perspective changed on life. And I was like, this stuff really is making sense to me now. And you know, I can see how this would be stressful, and I can see how I can choose, I can see how I can change my attitude. And so it made a huge difference in my life. And so from personal experience, that's really how I got into it, just kind of being quite stressed out with personal events, and then just looking for something, and then that kind of just fitted in and just made a lot of sense and really helped me from a personal level, definitely.
I think I was going to say, like, it's interesting that, you know, your perspective on life changed. You know?
Definitely.
So we found the same thing, isn't it? I mean, it's such a simple practice, you know, when you break it down, you know, your sort of definition is just a very sort of straightforward practice that you can explain to someone, but actually it's quite profound when you think about your perspective on life and the implications of being in the present moment and how often we're sort of away with it. And it does make a lot beyond the formal practice, and you know, the changes in the brain, just like, say, if you go to the gym and your muscles change, but it doesn't really change your perspective on life, whereas this actually has a massive shift. And we often talk about that aspect of it, don't we?
What always fascinates me in these kind of interviews is the way that you've, because I've always seen myself as very skinny. I've never really been too confident with the way I feel. And through the reading and understanding and learning about mindfulness, these are just thoughts they're almost a fiction. They're not real. It's just this stream of thoughts that come into your mind. And we've lived by these rules, these thoughts, and these rules all our life.
Yeah.
And the perception of who we are, how we're related to the rest to other people and to society and to the environment. This mindfulness gives you a completely new way in which to see all that.
It does.
And it's like a massive burden lifted off your shoulders. It's like you being open to the matrix and learning about this secret world. And for me, like, as I said, when I have conversations with people that have at least just passed that first level, then the rest of the we get it, we're on the same playing field now. And then everything else.
I remember talking about you said that you've always found yourself skinny. So I remember having a kind of moment where I just felt like, I mean, I say, you know, so we were talking about how men and don't find it very easy to kind of, you know, open up, but for women, I think that, not opening up, but I think for women have quite a hard time with the stuff that's bombarded at them through the media and so on, how they have to look, how they have to be. It's consistent, and you always feel like, oh, there's something wrong, or I'm supposed to look like this, or I'm supposed to look like this, and it goes on and on and on. And then I think I had a moment where I was practicing mindfulness, and I was like, I actually like myself. And it's taken so long to get to that point. And I actually see that all this stuff is just like messages given to me that are just really negative and nasty, and actually don't mean anything. And I'm sure that advertisers want you to hate yourself so they can buy your product, but I know what that's about. And now I'm like, no, I don't like myself as I am. I don't have to buy your clothes to feel good. I don't. So it's like opens up just even little things like that, just by practicing and just feeling, but these thoughts, who's putting these thoughts in my head, and why are they there, and what's
who is the person that's asking the question?
There's
the thoughts coming, and you say, well, what are these, who, where are these thoughts coming from? Well, who is the person that's asking? Where are these thoughts coming from? It's like that great Eckhart Tolle moment where he says, I can't live with myself anymore. Then he thought about, well, who is the I and who is the myself? You know, he separated himself from all these negative thoughts. And for me, that's the most fascinating part of the mindfulness.
So I was going to say, sort of nowadays, I think it's even worse than when we're growing up. I don't know if they've done any studies sort of with young people with Instagram and Facebook. I mean, obviously, all those social media things are useful. You know, I've never really been into social media myself, but I mean, they're a useful tool for sort of staying in touch with people. But I think there's more pressure now.
I definitely agree with you. You know, I think there's more, like, because obviously there's the tech revolution. So teenagers today, you know, they've grown up with the internet. They have it. But they've had all millions and millions of messages just thrown at them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just it actually causes anxiety because they're like, your brain is fried. Like, what am I supposed to believe? What am I supposed to do? You know, like multitasking. Like, there's so much information. And actually, you know, like we go on about how multitasking or society. I don't, because society goes on about how multitasking is good. I need a multitasking phone. I need a multitasking laptop. It can all do millions of things at once.
Mm.
All it does is just it's just fry your brain, because multitasking is actually pretty much a myth.
Mm.
All you do when you multitask is just switch your focus from one thing back to the other.
Yeah.
You actually can't do several things at once with like proper you can't do it.
Yeah.
I know I can't do it.
Yeah.
But all you're doing is just making yourself more anxious by thinking I need to do all these things at once, and you're and it doesn't make you productive either. And in workplaces say, oh, you need to multitask. Well, no, you don't. You need to concentrate on one thing at a time.
Yeah.
Multitasking is just going to exacerbate your anxiety.
Yeah. Really, a good analogy for that is the Sam Harris one, where you look outside a window, and then when you're looking outside, you can either see your reflection or you can see out,
mm-hmm.
but you can't really do both.
No, yeah, that's
so good. It's either you, when you focus on your reflection, you can see it clearly, and then when you kind of look outside, then you can see that clearly. But there's a very little small period where you're just in between both of them, and you're right, it's being present moment and doing one thing at a time.
Yeah.
And when you multitask, it's actually you're just doing a little bit of that and then a little bit of that. It's not actually going on at the same time.
You're just switching your focus. And that's, you know, that's not going to be... For me, I know that I need to... If I want to be productive, I know that it's just got to be that one thing that I focus on,
mm-hmm.
and give myself, however long I'm going to give myself, mm-hmm. you know, 2-3 hours of writing, and just focus just on that. It has to be that way for me. And that's how I've always worked. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the reaction after your book launch? And what impact has that had on your life?
The workbook, it was really... I didn't actually realise how popular that book would be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's done really well. So obviously Shamash and I are really proud of it. And when Ruby Wax endorsed it, we were really happy.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. She endorsed it this year and said, oh, check this out. So we were like, oh, wow. And then friends from all over the world have taken pictures of it in certain shops and bookcases, and I think, you know, my friends in Dubai have taken pictures of it there, and friends in France, it's in, like, I think Shamash took a picture when he went to Paris, and there was we have it. I mean, I've got four of them in Dutch at home, because it got bought by Amsterdam, and I don't have a I can't read Dutch, but it's very exciting to have it in Dutch, and then so it's really, really exciting to have it done, and definitely it's definitely opened up a lot of doors for me. You know, I'm about to do a mindfulness workshop next week in corporate companies, so I do that now a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really useful, because I actually feel, you know, like I'm actually bringing some mindfulness and some happiness to kind of employees in some quite corporate environments.
Yeah.
So it's fun.
So
I think it
must be a nice feeling also that sort of your work and your efforts, even if it's just one or two, I mean, I'm sure it's helped more than one or two people, but
mm-hmm.
the effort that you spent writing it and actually, you know, ultimately it's designed to help people, you know, with something that, like, you know, managing anxiety and things like, you know, what a great contribution that is to the wider world. I think there's a great feeling of satisfaction in that alone, you know, let alone, you know, whatever the success is, you know, internationally. But just knowing that you can help, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think it's sort of, it's an important step towards maybe greater sort of self, sort of happiness, I suppose, for your own sake. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's if you're allowed to be, you know, to celebrate something that you've achieved, I think something along the lines of helping others is no greater sort of reward, is there?
No, you're right. I love it. I think I set up my first sort of courses earlier this year. I did I taught an 8-week mindfulness course in South London where I live, and I think it was really nice. I sent an email asking for feedback, and this girl sent me a message saying that she just moved to London. She had quite bad anxiety. She was seeing a therapist as well as coming to my classes, and she said that her therapist noticed a change in her. Her friends had noticed a change in her, and she said, "I couldn't have been a better advert for your course because I feel so great now." And it just made me feel so happy that I'd actually like really helped someone and helped them to kind of feel, you know, like happy and content and, you know, excited by life again. And yeah, it was great. Yeah. Really felt good.
No, when I said to you about my sort of background in teaching, and we did a sort of a pilot mindfulness 3-minute breathing space in the classroom.
Yeah.
And so I did 10 years of, sort of teaching maths, running the basic, just classic teaching in the classroom, blah blah blah. And then we then threw in 3 minutes of mindfulness practice at the start. On a pilot basis at the college where I was teaching, and the reaction I got, you know, from the students, you know, so 10 years of teaching maths, and it was thank you, a nice sort of maybe card at the end of the year, box of chocolate, the usual, and then I'd go off to university and study maths, economics, physics, whatever. But that was it. I didn't really feel like I'd profoundly changed someone's life, you know. I did my best and I enjoyed mathematics and teaching. But just after maybe 3 months of incorporating mindfulness into the classroom, I had a couple of letters from students that said it's profoundly changed their lives.
Oh,
you know,
great.
And, you know, thank you letter. And that made me realise, wow, you know, 10 years of teaching maths and just 3 minutes at the start of the lesson, and there was a student, one in particular, who was suffering from depression. And I didn't realise at the time. He was just one of the students in the classroom. It didn't occur to me that he was actually suffering from depression quite badly, as it turned out. And he wrote a really lengthy, you know, heartfelt letter about how it's changed his life, and it made me realise, you know, what a difference it could make just introducing someone to this. Because although it's getting more mainstream and more widely known, I don't think that it's just the exposure. I don't think everyone's necessary. It's not something you turn on the TV and it's, you know about. It's still sort of something that you'd have to have it explained to you, and you have to invest a bit of time into
it.
It's
definitely something that people need to kind of, if they want to do it, it's definitely something that you kind of need to have a lot of patience for, and you also need to kind of have a bit of a beginner's mind, not bring your own concepts to it. So you need to kind of have an empty, it's hard to do that, but, you know, like, without all, like, ulterior perspectives of what it actually is, you kind of need to let go of that and just kind of come in with an open mind and an empty mind. And you also need to kind of know that it's not going to be a quick fix. I think that's quite important to hammer down to people, but just because, you know, people, especially because as it's gaining so much popularity, you know, that the media are saying things like, you know, like, it, you know, it's the new thing. It's not the new pill. It's not going to work like that. You have to put in dedication and time and effort, and also you have to try and let go of any expectations as well, because you think, oh, you can't really start a mindfulness course and go, this is going to make me happy, or because it's like, then you're just putting expectations on it, and actually all it is just about being accepting and aware. So if you're kind of pushing for that, then you're actually not being very mindful.
Also setting those high expectations for something, you know, that you think, oh, this is like the miracle drug or the panacea, and it's going to solve all of life's problems. It's just, you're asking for the impossible, because I think the reality of life is that inevitably there will be, you know, always will be sort of ups and downs.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely important to kind of know that, like, you know, you are not your anxiety, and also, like, just to perceive what you can and cannot control, and especially when you, say you have anxiety and you feel like it's all consuming, and and it's kind of like, you know, it's not actually, if you say you're going back to non-attachment, you know, it's not actually attached to you, and these things just take time for you to kind of change perspectives. They really do. I mean, you have to kind of have a lot of patience and a lot of willing, you know, and a lot of kind of just, you're prepared to be progressive and
a bit of open-mindedness.
Definitely open-mindedness. It's really important.
All right, so lastly, I want to read an excerpt from your book.
Okay.
You can manage stress by changing your habits and lifestyle and by using meditation. Small changes such as diet, sleep, and making time for yourself can be a big difference. Be kind to yourself and remember that you deserve not to be under constant stress, just like everyone else. Don't be afraid to ask for help if you need it, and try not to take on too much in your home and working life. And I think that's a pretty cool way to end the podcast. So get your hands on a copy of the book Managing Anxiety with Mindfulness for Dummies. Again, Joelle Jane Marshall. You'll find that in all good bookstores. We'll put up a link online where they can buy it through Amazon.
Thank you.
And if people want to follow you and want to find out a bit more, how can they reach you?
Generally, you can reach me at info@joellemarshall.com, or you can always tweet me at joemarshall2.
Okay. Well, alright, and Joe, thank you very much. We'll be in touch soon.
Thank you so much.
That I melted. Peace. I fell right through the cracks. Now I'm trying to get back. Before the cool done run out, I'll be giving it my best. This and nothing's gonna stop me but divine intervention. I reckon it's again.